Public hearing. All in our Senate Bill 870, which is Jen, is a bill that would do.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 870 would require Blue Mountain Community College, Treasure Valley Community College, and Eastern Oregon University to collaborate to develop a plan to instruct students on a semester basis rather than the quarterly basis that they have now.
Thank you. And since we have a quorum here, we're reopening this public hearing on Senate Bill 870. And we have before us Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Nelson. I'm State Senator from Pendleton. I represent Umatilla, Morrow, Union, and Wallowa counties in Northeast Oregon. And we're kind of along the I-84 corridor in a lot of those areas, and we actually extend down into, while my district doesn't extend down into Ontario, you will have a representative today here from Treasure Valley. And what this bill really is that it's an accumulation of a lot of activities that Eastern Oregon University, Blue Mountain Community College, and Treasure Valley Community College have worked in a partnership or conjunction and cooperation for several years now because they're serving that part of the state. A lot of their students end up going into either Idaho, University of Idaho, Boise State. Some go up into Eastern Washington. Eastern Washington, those schools are all basically on a semester basis. So what they're trying to do is be innovative. In this time, they're trying to figure out how we're going to deliver services better to the students, how we're going to provide this education, and so this is an idea that came out of basically we're sitting over a dinner one night and kind of writing down on the napkin and saying, okay, how can we make this thing better? And so this is where we're at, and they can explain it a lot better than I can, and I'd like to turn that over to the three gentlemen here that represent those institutions, and I think there's a student also.
Now, can I ask a question?
Sure. Yes.
Was that dinner over a grilled salmon at your house?
Yes, sir. No, it wasn't, but that brings back very fond memories, Senator.
You had grilled salmon at his house?
Absolutely, with a kind of a...
I'd like to do that sometime.
Well, the invitation's open.
Ooh.
Thank you very much. Introduce yourself for the record, and let's have your testimony, please.
Great, thank you. Senator Starr, my name is Phil Creighton. I'm from Eastern Oregon University, members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I appreciate the chance to talk to you about a very innovative project that the three institutions on the eastern side of the mountain propose a pilot study to convert to a semester system basis, and this pilot study would start in 2004-2005 and report back to the Education Committee in 3 years on the successes or the failures of this transition. What we're proposing to do is to pilot a semester system. And the reason this is so important for us is that, first of all, about 77% of the schools across America are on the semester system already. Only 11% of the higher education institutions are on quarter systems. The majority of the students we serve and relate to in Eastern Oregon are coming to us from semester systems. And so what we would like to propose is that we interrelate our programs with these programs we get most of our students from. In addition to that, these three institutions have worked very effectively together in an organization called the Eastern Oregon College Collaborative Center, the EOCCC, and we have a long history of being able to collaborate and work together. The majority of our students, for example, at Eastern Oregon University, come from our two community college partners as transfers. By having the same system of semesters, it would certainly be a good pilot study. We're hoping that this model could be used to convert both the system and the community college system to a semester system eventually. We think it would be an effective way of converting our systems to better serve the students. Currently, as you know, on a quarter system, we open and close three times a year as we begin three quarters. What we're proposing is to reduce that by one, and hopefully there would be significant savings from that reduction of services of starting a third quarter. So I'm very pleased to be here, Mr. Chair, and if I can answer any of the questions, I'd be pleased to do so.
Any questions?
Chairman Starr, Vice Chair Deckert, Senator Morissette. I'm Jim Sorensen, President of Treasure Valley Community College in Ontario, Oregon, and I live at 660 Hayden Drive, Ontario. I've been in the state for the past 3 years, but all of my career in higher education we've talked to, or I've been in a quarter system, we've always talked about moving over to a semester system for very good reasons and very good educational reasons. And that happened to be in the state of Washington. The east side of Washington State University, for example, is a semester institution, as are most of the privates. And in this state, most the privates are semester systems, and most of the publics, all the publics, are quarter-driven institutions. In most of my career, I served in student support services area, and in that area, you always do the startup and the stopping of each quarter and admissions, registration, and records 3 times a year, or 4 times when you include summer quarter. Semester system really allows you some true savings in the sense that you would only begin and end at least 2 times or 3 times, including summer quarter, so it actually has some benefits to the institution in a time when we've already cut 25% of our full-time employees, many of those in those support areas. I would much rather have our employees spend time supporting students in a very beneficial role rather than just doing paperwork in those processes that begin and end at the start and end of a quarter. So that's one of the reasons, but it has very strong educational reasons as well. Those are outlined in the research, although most of it's more anecdotal than it is hard data. I think, as Phil has pointed out, that 77% of the institutions nationwide are now on a semester system, and most of what is left is either in Washington, Oregon, or a couple of other states nationwide. So most institutions have already moved to that. The unique area of Ontario, in the sense that on the eastern side of the state, most of those students will remain on the east side. Some will come to the west side in the I-5 corridor to attend school, but most do stay on the east side of the state and either attend Eastern and or Boise State University of Idaho or Idaho State University. All of the Idaho schools are semester-driven institutions, so anytime I do curriculum development in Ontario, we are constantly setting up standards both for the Oregon side of the state, because we do have students that go to OSU or other places, and particularly Eastern in our case, as well as the Boise system in particular, where many of those students will attend. So it would make our curriculum development easier. This was something that was looked at about 10 years ago and fell apart at the last kind of minute as it moved through the system. We believe that we can do this in a cost-effective manner. There's no money tied to this. This is a pilot program. We will continue to work together as three institutions serving the rural areas of the state and trying to save money and make as much access to our students as possible. And we believe that this bill is a win-win for everybody.
Thank you. Questions?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Travis Kirkland. I'm the president of Blue Mountain Community College. I live in Pendleton. We have campuses over an 18,000-square-mile area of eastern Oregon, so I get a lot of windshield time. I agree with my colleagues, so I won't repeat what they've said. At least I'll try not to. Let me take the tack that this bill is good for students. It's good for students because our students at community colleges and at EOU are not terribly affluent. We're on the eastern side of the state. Right now, under the quarter system, our students have to pay perhaps $300 or $400 more a year for textbooks because they have to buy another term of textbooks, and that's rough on people, particularly when we have 70 or 80% of them working, 70, 80, or 90% of them on financial aid. A few dollars makes a big difference in whether somebody stays in college or not. Another real benefit for the semester system is you have a tremendous amount of flexibility in offering short courses and shorter terms and other opportunities. If there's a big fire and people can't start right on, you know, when you typically start in August, it's a simple matter under the semester system to extend the time in class and start a 9-week session. It happens all over the country, and that's the kind of thing you can do with semester systems. We've already talked about the more efficient use of our staff. This is the only time you may hear in several days when somebody from education comes in and says, we're not asking you for money, and we're not. We're asking you to give our students a better opportunity to be successful, to save them money, and to be more effective for them regionally, not just in Oregon. So there's a no-cost thing. 63% of our students go to EOU. That's a cost thing. And it's a good idea for Eastern Oregon. So that's another strong argument, I believe, for this effort. My handout that you have there has some other things, but I'm not going to beat those up. this is just one of the better ideas that I've seen, and I really do urge you to support this. I'd be glad to stand for any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions? I have no question. I want to thank you for bringing this to us. I think that it's time that we piloted this opportunity, and I think it will be good for students. I think one of the benefits, of course, is the opportunity to get out and work a little earlier in the year. Having worked my own way through college under a semester system, I know how important that can be.
And that does matter.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, my name is Scott Pugger, and I'm a student at Eastern Oregon University. From the students' perspective, we see a lot of benefits from this. As they're saying, we're going to save money in books, and the textbooks now are currently geared for semesters as opposed to quarters. And so we never, in the quarter system, get fully through a book or all the way through a book. And so I think that we'll be able to learn more in our respective classes using the semester system. Also, the summer job market is a very competitive market, and for people who get out later, it's more difficult to find a job for us. And so I think that we'll be more competitive in the job market if under the semester system, because we get out a little bit earlier. And I think they've pretty much summed up all the advantages. Is there any questions?
No questions. Thank you very much.
I would like a question for President Creighton.
We spoke this morning and we talked a little bit about the Board of Higher Education and the Chancellor's Office and so on. So is there any opposition from the Department of Higher Ed or the Chancellor's Office?
Yeah. Chairman Starr, Senator Morissette, the Chancellor's Office has been neutral in its position. They're supportive of our piloting the program and to see how this reflects back to the system.
Okay, so then this is a pilot program then?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate you coming over, and I hope you have a safe trip back.
Thank you.
We are under a posting here that says this is referral to Ways and Means, but I believe, based on the testimony we've received, there's no dollars required, no requests for funding. I'm going to suggest that we ask to rescind the referral to Ways and Means. With that, I'm closing the public hearing, opening a work session on Senate Bill 870.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Deckard.
I move that we rescind the referral to Ways and Means, and can we do it in one?
Mm-hmm.
And that we move Senate Bill 870 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Deckard has moved that we rescind the referral to Ways and Means and send Senate Bill 870 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Clerk, call the roll.
Do pilot
recommendation. Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Vice Chair Deckard?
Aye.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, Senate Bill 870 is moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation, provided we get the President to rescind the referral.
Should we have Senator Nelson carry it?
And yes, we're going to have Senator Nelson carry this bill on the Senate floor.
He's still here.
He's not here, but I'm sure he won't be very glad to carry the bill. With that, we close the work session on Senate Bill 870, and we open a public hearing on Senate Bill 651. Senator Morissette, you going to introduce this for us?
Do I have to go down there?
No, you don't have to go down there.
I'd like a salmon dinner from Senator Morissette, also on charcoal.
Is that... that's very healthy food. Okay, Senate Bill 651 deals with what I consider to be a very important issue and a problem in our society. We're dealing with schools, and we're dealing with adequate diet We're dealing with health. We're dealing with obesity. Oregon, we're dealing with hunger. Oregon, as the hungriest state in the nation, is also one of the most obese states. In fact, west of the Mississippi, and I have a chart that shows a map of the United States, and it shows Oregon in the red as being one of the higher states in terms of obesity. A conference that I attended this last year dealt in detail with this problem and talked about what some of the other states have done in dealing with the issue, including the types of food that are served in schools. Are you handing me a candy bar to munch on while I'm doing this? Go ahead. Enjoy yourself. So this is a beginning, I think, the beginning of a process. This is not the final solution. We've worked with a group called Upstream Public Health, and they're interested in dealing with nutritious food in schools. I know that the school lunch program has some standards that we could use. I also know that schools are in a crisis mode in terms of funding. And so one of the solutions, at least for, say, after school sports and so on, has been to sign contracts with vending companies for soda pop machines and other types of food, some of which are not really the most nutritious. I know that school lunch programs have been privatized in many cases. I know that there are opportunities for kids to eat a variety of foods, and I know they have choices. I also know that physical education has been reduced in schools, health education has been reduced in schools, and bus transportation has been increased in schools. Kids don't walk now. They go home and watch TV. They don't get the exercise. They eat a lot of junk food. And obesity is a serious, serious problem. Now, we don't solve the problem immediately. We simply do it in small steps, and I would like to start with this small step. I think that the Department of Education has worked with the Upstream Public Health Group, and they are coming to an agreement. We do have -2 amendments. There will be some -3 amendments coming, but we do have people here to testify, and I would like to discuss the bill today. Do we want to talk about the -2s before we have testimony?
Are the -2s the ones we're talking about primarily effective today?
Yes. There is still something to be done, and that will be discussed during the testimony, but I think it's important to read the -2s, because if people have not had an opportunity to see them, then they will miss some of the context in which we're speaking. So I think if we could just review the -2s.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you should have attached to your staff measure summary a copy of the -2 amendments dated yesterday from Senator Morissette, and these do a number of things. The -2 amendments prohibit the sale of food or drink at schools with students in grade 5 or below if the food or drink does not meet the standards of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National School Lunch Program and School Breakfast Program. This would first apply in the 2003-2004 school year, and it would not apply to contracts entered into before July 1, 2003. For schools with students in grades 6 through 8, it would prohibit the sale of food or drink if the food or drink does not meet the standards of the U.S. Department of Ag's National School Lunch Program and School Breakfast Program, unless the food or drink is sold after school hours or on days when school is not in session, except under certain conditions. So if the food meets these conditions, it could be served. If the food is sold in addition to the normal breakfast and lunch programs, if the food contains less than 10% of total calories from saturated fat, excluding nuts and seeds, contains less than 35% of total calories from fat, and excluding fruits and vegetables, contains less than 35% of total weight from sugar. It directs school districts to make available the policies of the school district related to the sales of food and drink, requires school districts to post a sign that describes the district's policy concerning the sales of food and drink, requires school districts to annually report to the Department of Education their policies and compliance with the policies, and also prohibits the placement of vending machines on school property if the surface of the vending machine contains an advertisement.
All right. That is the latest amendment we have in committee. And with that, we're going to begin the testimony. And is there an order here?
No.
Senator, just bring up the...
Yeah.
Well, let's come up three at a time, and we start with Gary Boyce, John Borowski, and then we got, oh boy, I have real trouble.
Craig. Come on up, Craig.
We were actually the three of us from up in public.
Oh, okay. All right, we'll start with the two of you. Please. Please introduce yourself and...
Hi, I'm Gary Boyes. Pleasure to be here. I'm a father of children in the Salem-Keizer School District. Very concerned about this very issue. Appreciate the opportunity to talk today. I think Senate Bill 651 is an extremely necessary bill. I realize it's still going through changes, and I think those are good changes. My personal opinion is it should be tightened up. It's not widely known. It's certainly not a big deal in the press. No great hue and cry coming up from the public. But they're kind of unsuspecting. They don't understand the issue. This issue is largely kept from the parents in a circumstantial sort of fashion. There's not a lot of parents out there that even realize what the situation is inside the public schools. You know, waiting for the hue and cry of the public and for huge amounts of support is, I don't think, is very proactive lawmaking when we're talking about health issues. I did send in a fairly detailed rundown of what I've recently learned, especially regarding Pepsi's contracting locally here, which I believe is indicative of across the state and across the United States. I strongly encourage each of you to read it if you haven't. In any decision-making situation, you need to know, you know, who it is you're dealing with, and that sometimes they're not always as purely motivated as we might think. The public school system has a single, simple primary mission. That's to provide a quality education to the children of the state in a wholesome environment. That's the basis of the public trust of the institution. It's still the expectation, even the assumption of the public, that the focus remains on that goal. I have found out, sadly, that that's not exactly true. The bigger picture on this issue does not require taking anything else into account. Indeed, focusing on the big picture actually requires not considering anything else. I know there's difficulties in school funding, but doing something wrong at school to try to replace funds is not exactly an option. The primary mission of public education needs to be the top consideration in all circumstances. That's the very heart of the public trust. I ask that during all this discussion and testimonies on this subject from anyone who wishes to speak, public or private, that you continually bear in mind the primary objective of the public school system and its anchorage in the public trust. In doing so, it should become readily apparent that there is a clear difference between school business and the business being done with schools. There are those among us here today that represent the desire to reestablish a wholesome learning environment with a high-quality product produced as a result of undisturbed quality instruction. We come to represent a public that has been largely and intentionally left in the dark on this issue. There are those among us here today that are paid to protect the special interests of those that currently occupy and degrade the educational environment in this state. They represent those that consume school time, administrative resources, occupy the minds of students as best they can with visual commercial messages, and have no care for adequate health and nutrition save for the lip service in the hopes of fending off popular opinion. They profit hugely from the advertising access to this desired audience that's collected together for them by mandate of the state. They take much and, on actual balance, contribute less than nothing in return. There are also those among us today that work to protect the interests of those responsible parties in school administration that have allowed for and even arranged for the degradations in both the quality of public instruction and the environment in which what's left of it is delivered. The very fact that lobbyists are paid here to protect what they claim is break-even business, and lobbyists are here to represent the interests of administrations that support it, is telling. It's a testament in itself to how easily the corporations think we can be fooled and how off course from the primary mission the administrative structure is. They come hoping to preserve the incursions and occupations at the expense of your taxpayers and their children. They hope to see you convinced that unhealthy interference and blatant profiteering in the public school system is something other than that, and that it should be accepted as the new standard. You must provide to the children and voting public of this state their expected due by clarifying through your decisive actions that we already have a standard and intend to see it met again. If you'll bear in mind the primary mission of the public schools and the expectations of the public trust and gauge all parties' input by that measure, I'm confident that you'll see there's no validity whatsoever in the continuance of the currently incorrect situation. No one here would argue against what the primary obligations of public instruction are, but some would work very hard to convince you that their advertising, profiting, occupation of administrative time, and provision of unhealthy products, all subsidized by taxpayer education dollars, have no ill effect. Indeed, they even want to be viewed as helpful. Simply put, there is a fundamental flaw in structure and lack of regulation that allows large or even multinational corporations to negotiate directly with district administrations that are overseen by volunteer boards. How in the world would schools and our children be expected to ever come out on top in an exchange like that? I urge you strongly to realize the actual gravity of the current situation in our public schools. This bill, in its strongest form, is an important step in the right direction. The root of the problem is the ability to sell, trade, or lease out advertising access to the children of this state in public schools. This must also be brought to an abrupt halt in order to protect Oregon children from the weaknesses of local boards and administrations against the opportunistic marketing activities of corporate America. They will continue to interrupt, damage, degrade, and profit from public schools as long as a captive audience is left available to them. The system must be protected from this at the state level. Absolutely nothing should stand in the way of the delivery of a top-quality public education in a wholesome environment. Sanctity is preserved through limitations placed or implemented to protect the desired status of the public school system. This is the assumption of the electorate, not something they expect to need to fight for. It's not about money for schools. If it were, it would be about the amount of taxpayer dollars spent in pursuit of and support of these deals that have damaged and continue to adversely affect the public learning environment. Unless special interests wish to differ with that, they literally should have nothing to say about it. This Senate bill needs to be supported, needs to be strengthened. Especially high schools need to be added back into it if they were in it to begin with. It needs to be passed as a powerful reflection of this state's understanding of the expectations and assumptions of the electorate regarding the future of education in Oregon. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. Questions?
I was just unclear if you're for or against.
I think nay is the term to use in this building.
My name is John F. Borowski, and I'm a resident of Philomath, and I travel up here every day anxiously to work in North Salem High School. I've been teaching environmental and marine science for 24 years, and I take the responsibility of the public schools very seriously. Every day, I'm given the responsibility of dealing with students' safety, with their education, giving them a safe environment in which to work in and to learn in, which includes being free of harassment, not being fearful of being in that environment, and also being kept healthy. Now, I'm a very vocal opponent of the commercialization of our schools for a number of reasons, but I'll cut right to the chase in terms of the biggest reason I'm here is the 55 or 60 million children that we have in the public schools are probably the greatest gift we have for the future. And I don't see them as negotiable commodities. As Gary stated, they're in the public school system to acquire the skills and tools needed to be productive citizens. And that functionability of being productive is based on being healthy. Critics will quickly say that, you know, John Borowski, you work in a high school, these young people have the choice to buy these products if they're placed in the school. I say that most parents are not aware of the fact that these vending machines are in school. Secondly, here, as a science teacher, I teach about the growing problem of obesity, as Senator Morissette brought up and showed so eloquently in that chart. I talk about osteoporosis and diseases related to obesity, but yet my own school district has a contract with Pepsi over a 10-year period that has nothing to do with bringing money in for a quality education. It has everything to do with making our kids in this captive situation lifelong consumers of that product. And we have to be honest about that. If the PepsiCo Corporation, which is worth $27 billion as of September 2002, had the concerns of education foremost in their heart, then they could write a check, go down to my principal, shake her hand, put the picture on the wall, and we cash the check and use it for better programs in our school. I'm not saying that Pepsi or candy vendors don't have the right to sell their products in public places, but those sales are not those sales are based on, I think, a parent being with their child and that parent overseeing that the decision be made in the best interest of the child. So I take my role as a teacher very seriously, that I'm there to protect the health of those children in the school. I watch students come in every morning and go to the vending machines as their first stop, and that acts as a substitute for having a good breakfast. I see students in my school consume 2 and 3 and 4 pops in a school day time frame. Now, I don't let the kids drink pop in my classroom, and I take the time to explain why and why I'm in favor of seeing these vending machines and these vending contracts removed from the school. And for the most part, they've been pretty receptive. What I think we're doing is we're duping young people into becoming faithful consumers of a product. We're not offering them a free choice of a whole healthy array of products. Often the vending machines are front-loaded in places that are in the heaviest traffic flow. They're in our cafeteria. And this sends a message to kids. And I look back on, I have two daughters. I look back on my two daughters who said that, and they still say that, that there's tremendous reverence for school. You know, Dad, teacher said this today. It's almost as good as gold. You know, and what we're saying to kids, that we're tacitly saying that your health is negotiable in the school, that we're willing to use you as pawns for large corporate interests. And I think that's a horrible message to be sending. So to reiterate just a couple quick things and finish, I think 651 is a good start. I think it should include high schools. To be perfectly honest, I believe that vending machines and pop contracts have no place in the public school system. No place whatsoever. And I, as I said, parents can take their kids out into the outside arena, outside of school, consume those products. Most of the times those products are considered a treat, where now those products are becoming a mainstay in our kids' everyday break periods, their everyday cafeteria times, their everyday before and after school activities. And all the statistical data about obesity, about osteoporosis, to interject, I've never had so many meetings in the last 3 years for diabetes like I've had in North Salem, where we have to go to special sessions as teachers who have kids with diabetes in our classroom. So I see this as just one big long list of negative things that these contracts are bringing into the school. So I urge that this bill be strengthened, and then I urge that the public, particularly what Gary said, that the public is made aware of a lot of the behind-the-scenes issues of these contracts are not brought to light. We have a 10-year Pepsi contract. It's stated that it's going to bring the school district $4.7 million. Well, this is based on increasing the sales of the product each of those 10 years 5% every year. So the schools are actually becoming a marketing tool to guarantee more money brought in. That's not our job. Our job is not to use kids as pawns in the school system for the needs of a multinational's profit sheet. Our job is to teach civility, to teach basic citizenship skills, critical thinking. And how can we teach those things if our own children who look to us as adults see us failing in our roles as caring elders by having their most primary concerns in our hearts, and that's their health? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Any questions? Appreciate your testimony. Thank you for coming in. Now we had three members from upstream.
You got something to share?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Craig Mosbeck. With me today are Raquel Borjanesk and Noel Dobson. We're here representing Upstream Public Health. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for providing us this opportunity to talk to you about Senate Bill 651. You may have heard these statistics before, but they are still striking. Nationally, adolescent obesity has tripled in the last 20 years. Being overweight puts a person at risk for heart disease, diabetes, and many other chronic diseases. Obesity-related chronic diseases cost the state hundreds of millions of dollars each year. 28%, over a quarter of Oregon eighth graders, are currently overweight. Childhood obesity is an epidemic, and we must do something about it. Schools may have the best opportunity to influence health and nutrition habits because students spend such a large portion of their day in school. Our children spend 6 hours a day in school, eating one, possibly two regular meals, along with additional snacks. Schools should be a place where children learn about nutrition and healthy eating. The health education messages are clear. Eat a diet low in fat, low in processed sugar. Eat foods with vitamins and minerals such as fruit, vegetables, and milk. Schools participate in the federal school lunch and breakfast programs, and schools must abide by federally mandated nutrition guidelines for these meals. Competitive foods are defined as those foods that are sold outside of the school meal programs. There are no restrictions on competitive foods. So what happens when the child leaves the classroom and sees what is being sold to them through the vending machines or in the school stores, and sold to them not just by anonymous corporations, but sometimes by the school system itself? Soda pop, potato chips, and junk food. We know kids will buy more junk food than healthy foods, but we do not need to encourage kids to eat more. We have an obesity epidemic. So why is junk food being sold in the schools? Simply put, to make money at the expense of our children's health. Our goal should be to keep kids healthy. I have a 5-year-old daughter in kindergarten in public school. I work with her so that she has a good diet. When she's in middle school, you all know that I will have much less control over her diet. As a parent, I need the school to be my partner in ensuring that she has a healthy diet. SB 651, with the proposed amendments, is a modest step towards improving the school nutrition environment. Raquel Borjanesc will now describe the proposed amendments and why we urge you to support Senate Bill 651.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Raquel Borjanesc. Before I speak about the specifics of our proposed amendments to SB 651, I would like to acknowledge the Department of Education's assistance in crafting a workable bill and their leadership on this very important public health issue. The state of Oregon currently has no policy regulating competitive food in schools, and it's time. Upstream Public Health has worked on this bill with physicians, dietitians, dentists, public health professionals, parents, teachers, students, and the leadership of Senator Morissette. There is strong scientific evidence that junk food and soda consumption contributes to the childhood obesity epidemic. My colleague Craig Mossbach highlighted some of these serious consequences of obesity and why schools should not be in the business of selling junk food to kids. SB 651 is part of the solution. While some states have huge sweeping bans, our proposed amendments are a moderate step on a long road ahead. Why now? Why should this legislative session and this education committee be the ones to take this first step? Because we cannot afford to wait any longer. Oregon has learned that doing nothing is a very expensive option. Expensive to the state of Oregon, to our children, and to the community at large. In drafting our amendments to SB 651, we were hoping to have little to no fiscal impact on schools, have no fiscal impact on the state of Oregon, and yet improve the school nutrition environment, thus improving the health of students. Upstream Public Health and ODE have agreed on a set of proposed amendments. Our proposed amendments require that the sale of competitive food and beverages sold to students in elementary and middle schools must meet nutritional guidelines that limit fat and sugar. These are examples of some foods that can be sold under these proposed amendments. Some pretzels and baked chips as opposed to fried. Currently, high schools generate the greatest revenue of sale of competitive foods, and this bill puts no restrictions on food and beverage sales or contracts at the high school level. In closing, with our children's health at stake, we stand committed to this issue, and we are confident of the contents of the proposed amendments. Thank you for your time. Noelle.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Noelle Dobson, and I'd like to speak today about the federal and statewide momentum that inspired Senate Bill 651. In response to the health and financial threats posed by competitive foods, in 2001, Congress requested the report, Food Sold in Competition with USDA School Meal Programs. This congressional report concluded that competitive foods do have diet-related health risks, do undermine the viability of the school meal program, and do convey a mixed message to students about healthy nutrition. Clearly, this calls national attention to the fact that unhealthy competitive foods are a negative influence on our children. This congressional report recommends strong state laws that ensure that all foods sold in school, including competitive foods, meet nutritional standards. Such strong national attention to the issue of competitive foods has strengthened the efforts of a growing movement of advocates across the country who want healthier schools and healthier students. As this momentum grows, so do the number of organizations nationwide that are sending the clear message, it is not okay to sell junk food to children. These organizations include the American School Food Service, the National Governors Association, the National Association of State Boards of Education, and the American Federation of Teachers. We strongly support a statewide policy on competitive foods because it assures that all Oregon students are less vulnerable to the health threats of junk food. Other states agree. Almost 20 states have passed laws regulating the sale of unhealthy foods and beverages in school. For example, on the West Coast, California passed Senate Bill 19 that goes into effect in 2004, and Washington state legislators are considering Senate Bill 5436 this term. These two bills have nutritional standards similar to SB 651. The time has come for Oregon to adopt a statewide competitive food policy. Health advocates and children advocates across the state are mobilizing around these issues. In a dramatic call to arms this February, a council of nutrition professionals convened by the Oregon Department of Human Services hosted an extremely well-attended conference and released a statewide public health nutrition plan. This plan encourages making the healthy choice the easy choice in Oregon communities, including Oregon schools. The message from the plan and from the attendees around the state was clear. Schools must do a better job at promoting healthy eating and healthy lifestyles. The plan recommends strategies and statewide policies that limit access to soft drinks and fast food in schools. We have heeded their recommendation and worked hard to craft a bill that protects our children's health and maintains the financial viability of the schools. This is important work to be done in Oregon, and the time is right to enact Senate Bill 651. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and we'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you very much. Senator Deckard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just thank you for the testimony. Just one question. How do you respond? You use the word choice often, and I think that's the operative word. How do you respond to the argument that we have a choice, just choose not to put your coins into the vending machine and purchase those items?
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, I think that's a great argument for some when you're talking about adults and things that are available at the corner grocery store. But in our schools, you know, especially elementary schools, it's people who are kids who are less than 8, 9 years old, and you know, we haven't given them sort of the right to make certain choices in their life, the right to smoke cigarettes, the right to do many other things. And I think we want to teach them that the right choice is the healthy choice and encourage that behavior any way we can, both through health messages and what's available in the schools.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Kate Tarter.
Kate Tarter. Joyce Doherty.
Yes. Introduce yourselves and let's hear your testimony, please.
Hi. I'm Kate Tarter, and a parent with two sons in the Salem School District. And I wanted to come here today and share some of my experiences with the school and system and the foods offered and some of my concerns. And my one main point is the school does have an impact on my children. And I'll start with my youngest, who goes to elementary school, who brought this after-school product called Fruit Works home, which has 250 total calories. And when you calculate the label, the amount of sugar in this is the same equivalent of Coca-Cola. Carbohydrates, it even has higher calorie than Coca-Cola. It has 5% juice. I feel disgusted that my second-year-old goes to school and can bring this home after school. And I feel like the first two gentlemen who spoke, this bill does not go far enough. I also have a child in middle school, and I am active in helping them with the social club. And as an advocate of healthy food, I expose the kids to sugar-free water. Without 35 kids, not one complaint, it's flavored water, no calories. What I'm saying is that the school has a choice to influence my children by exposing them to different food choices. And I am very concerned about the fact that the school puts this in a vending machine with a water decal all over it. There are approximately 10 selections. One is water. The other 9 are this, pop. And they're calling it fruit. And that's in the elementary school. In the middle school, also after-school program, they sell candy bars, and they sell another equivalent of this. So the thing is that when I called the school to complain, they said, well, it's up to you to teach your child. Why am I fighting the school? what health book says supplement your diet with soda pop? I feel, and candy bars, I feel that I am fighting the school, and I am asking you to please pass this to give me as a parent a tool to protect both my children's health. And I am concerned that they're saying that this is the only way they can make money. I personally am actively doing fundraisers with the school, and I did some reading on the ASU website, which is documented in San Francisco. They recently had another middle school go through the same thing, switch over to water. They said they were going to lose money, and instead they've increased. So I debunked that the school is not going to lose all this money. It's documented on the ASU website under the educational policies. So, anyway, a little more from there.
Can I ask her?
Yes.
What you're saying, the website documents that healthy foods are put in the machines and they are...
Not losing money.
Not losing money. So... what do you mean by, I wonder what they put in, real fruit juice perhaps?
No, the PE department put bottled water in the middle school. Okay. And it's documented right there. That it's in San Francisco middle school. They got a lot of flack in the beginning saying, we're going to lose money, we need our pop. They took the pop away, they put the water in, and that's one of the things they're saying is that they're seeing an increase in sales. And it may be because the parents will give them money if they're going to buy water, not pop. I don't know what that exactly attributed to, but I'm saying I'm not buying some of their philosophy.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Joyce Doherty, Director of the Child Nutrition and Food Distribution Programs, and with me is Heidi Dupuy, a Child Nutrition Specialist within the Child Nutrition Programs. The Child Nutrition Programs are located within the Office of Student Services. There are currently 20 staff in Child Nutrition, myself, 4 support staff, 1 information specialist, and 14 child nutrition specialists who work directly with schools and private nonprofit organizations. Superintendent Castile supports Senator Morissette's effort on this issue. Childhood obesity is a serious public health concern. The Oregon Department of Education is always reluctant to meddle with local control. However, one of the reasons we have a Department of Education and one of the reasons there is a legislature is to establish some statewide standards. We believe that the issue of child nutrition in the schools is an issue of sufficient statewide concern that state standards are appropriate. We recognize that schools are desperate for money, but the solution is for the legislature to fund schools adequately, not for schools to sell products that are detrimental to student health. In Oregon, over 90% of elementary and middle schools participate in the National School Lunch Program. The health, learning potential, and achievement of Oregon's children are enhanced by the nutritional benefits provided by these meals programs. Federal regulations require schools participating in the lunch and breakfast programs to serve meals that meet dietary guidelines and certain nutrition standards. Although school meals are becoming healthier, competitive foods, those that compete with USDA school meals, are becoming more common. Competitive foods do not have to meet nutrient standards. The sale of competitive foods in schools can negatively affect children's diet, since many are high in fat, calories, and sugar, and low in nutrients. There are very few competitive foods sold at the elementary schools. However, there has been a drastic increase of competitive foods sold at middle schools. Selling low nutrition foods in schools contradict nutrition education and sends children the message that good nutrition is not important. Currently, 19 states have state competitive food policies. The Surgeon General's Call to Action to Prevent and Decrease Overweight and Obesity, 2001, recommends policies specifying that all foods and beverages available at school contribute toward eating patterns that are consistent with the dietary guidelines for Americans. We have gone through several drafts of this legislation with the Senator's office. We would like to highlight some of the issues that we have raised in those discussions. We believe that the standards for food should be expressed in terms of limiting the grams of fat and grams of carbohydrates in food items rather than in the percentage of calories in food from fat or sugar. A percentage of calories requirement would be particularly difficult to administer, requiring analysis of food items that could be time-consuming and complex. We also believe the legislation should prohibit the sale of candy and other foods of minimal nutritional value as defined by federal law. We believe that the law should be effective as of July 1, 2005, to give schools a transition period. New contracts for food that does not meet these standards could not extend beyond July 1, 2005, but a district could extend a current contract or even enter a new contract for non-competitive foods up until that date. In part, this suggestion is based on our sensitivity to the current fiscal crisis in the schools. We think that any reporting requirement should be as simple as possible and should not go beyond simply requiring districts to verify that they are in compliance with this act. Such a report could be included with other reporting already required. We do not support a complete ban on advertising, but we would support a requirement that advertisements placed on vending machines be limited to advertising the food that is in the machine. If soda may not be sold in school, soda should not be advertised either. We want to ensure that foods sold outside of the school meal programs make a positive contribution to the children's diet, to children's diets, and do not undermine the national investment of the National School Lunch Program and the School Breakfast Program. We are happy to answer any questions.
One question. I called my own school district in Springfield and asked them about the number of machines in schools, and they told me that up until recently, each principal was allowed to negotiate their own contract. They've changed that. They are now doing a district-wide contract. And I said, well, how many elementary schools? And I was told that one elementary school had a machine. Now, I'm curious if you have any information about numbers of elementary schools throughout the state. I don't know if you have a way of gathering that, but I sense that it hasn't uniformly reached the elementary level yet, but I'm concerned that it may soon. Do you have any data on...
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, there is national data in terms of looking at the number of elementary schools that have vending machines, and you're correct that the numbers are increasing. We don't have specific numbers for the state of Oregon.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Yes, did you wish to testify?
No,
she's with me.
All right. Thank you.
Now, let me ask you just another question then. The amendments that we have, the dash 2 amendments, are that's not the final draft, right? You are working on these other. Did you discuss then the ones that you are currently working on this sheet? For instance, limiting grams of fat and carbohydrates and so on.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, we are making those changes with the new amendment.
Okay, good. And there is an agreement with the proponents of this bill.
That's correct.
And I guess most importantly, and probably it's kind of ironic because the thing we value most is money, and the thing that will kill this bill is money. And we're going to hear from the school districts who are probably going to say this is a terrible bill because we're going to lose money. So money is the bottom line. Is there a fiscal impact?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morissette, we don't know what that fiscal impact will be. I think that as Kate has spoken, right now where there are certain foods that are in vending machines, we're suggesting that those be replaced with others. We don't know what that impact will be.
I do have one suggestion for elementary children. Why do you have to supply food? Can't you have a vending machine with toys? Rubber balls, Yu-Gi-Oh cards, something non-food. I mean, there are other forms of entertainment.
Okay, but money is still the bottom line.
I was just saying that I don't buy it. They need to work the problem. There's many solutions, and I don't feel that. I think it's laziness, and they've relied on this one. They found one thing that worked, and they don't want to change it. It's just my opinion.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. We are
Proceeding with the public hearing with the subcommittee of the Education Committee present, Chuck Bennett, Don Marshall, Patty O'Sullivan, come forward, please.
Oh, here they come. I know.
To be sure there's no money here.
I know there's no money.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Patty O'Sullivan. I work for Portland Public School District. I'm here today to oppose this bill. I have a number of things I want to talk about. The first thing is the assumption that school districts, school board members, people that work in districts don't care about nutrition of kids. We care very, very much. I'll be telling you about policies that we've adopted in concert with parents, with our nutritional staff, with teachers, and that were approved by our board after a lot of back and forth about nutritional value of foods. Unfortunately, we also have to talk about money. Let me just read you the purpose of our policies. Purpose of the Portland Public School policy on it is food sales are allowed only to fulfill curriculum activities or district fundraising requirements. However, since the board believes that good nutrition is important for high academic achievement, all food service operations, including vending machines, student stores, school marketing classes, and fundraisers, should offer food choices that provide the opportunity for students to select products that reflect the nutrition principles taught within the health curriculum. A couple of things that are in our policies and our administrative directives are directly focused on that competitiveness of these types of things that are sold and what happens at school lunch and school breakfast. We have school breakfast program in our district. A couple of things that I will start with. Elementary schools, we do not allow vending machines in elementary schools, in any elementary schools. The children are served milk and 100% juice with their meals. There is a vending machine in teacher break rooms where children are not allowed, nor are they allowed to go in there and get it. This bill and the amendments would prohibit that, as far as I can read. In middle schools, we have vending machines that are only allowed to sell water and 100% fruit juice, and the times are restricted to afternoons, 30 minutes after lunch. And then if they have a regular vending machine with pop or something like that in it, that can be opened up, unlocked only after school hours. In high school, we do allow vending machines, although they're turned off during the lunch hour and then opened up after lunch. We do allow, and this bill isn't just about pop, so I will talk about other food products that are sold in our schools. During lunch in middle schools, you might have as a side dish a piece of pizza. You might have a brownie. And the nutritional value content is looked at on, it's not looked at food by food by food. I don't think, I mean, most nutritionists will say it's okay to have a brownie once in a while. You just shouldn't eat them all day, every day. It's looked at in terms of a week of nutritional value. Whatever we sell adds up to going within the standards over a period of time so that your nutritional value of what we're serving the kids is you know, based on a weekly accumulative measure. So we have extensive policies and ADs on this, and like I said, there are some things in these policies that talk about competitiveness. For instance, vending prices should not favor carbonated beverages, isotonics, or juice drinks over water or 100% juice. Beverages at the same price may come in a reasonable range of sizes. So they cannot charge less for pop in a high school than they charge for water. It all has to cost the same so that it's there. The kid has a buck or whatever it is, they have choices and wouldn't be limited by a monetary choice and thrown towards the pop as opposed to the water. We also have things like they can't contain anything greater than 5 milligrams of caffeine per ounce. They can't have herbal additives designed or promoted as a producing a stimulant effect. They accept for provided by the board distribution of funds to participating schools shall not be linked to sales levels. So the money that comes in goes into a pot and is then distributed evenly among schools so that there's no competitiveness. The advertising is also controlled in middle schools that sell only water. The company, we have a contract with Coca-Cola. They offer different vending machines, and the vending machines in middle schools only advertise water. That's the picture on the vending machines. It's not pop, it's water. In the high schools, it could be either. We pick those out. They allow that. It's allowed in our contract. So we've been very, very judicious about making sure that yes, we provide things. We don't want to tell everybody what to do every minute of a day, but we are there to educate kids, and we understand that children are easier to educate when they're not all hyped up on sugar, when they've had good food, that we serve them at breakfast, we serve them at lunch, and if they have a snack in the afternoon. Your bill would also prohibit, in elementary level, the PTA or Girl Scouts selling cookies or having a bake sale at the end of the day. We don't allow them in school during the school day, but at the end of the day, they could have a table outside or in the front hall, and your bill would not allow that. So, on to the money.
Now, wait just a minute.
Mm-hmm.
I ask a question. Would you please work with us then in helping to draft our bill to make it acceptable to people? I really like what you're doing in Portland, and you don't allow it in elementary schools. You have limited middle schools, and I think you've got some great points. And so we would really, could we hire you as a consultant to work with our group?
I think that would be a conflict of interest. Chair Starr, Senator Morissette, I'm not done with my testimony.
Oh, well, I wanted to. Okay.
But I did. My point was not to come here and say, oh, goody, we comply with the bill, so we don't care.
Yeah.
That the piece that we care about is the local control, and the piece of should the state be regulating this kind of thing in school districts. As you can see, our school district and our parents and our teachers have all come together and talked about this and adopted policies. And there were people there on that committee that wanted much more stringent policies and some that didn't really care. So this was a compromise. You know, is it a good compromise? Yes. Do I know that all school districts abide by something like this? My guess is they probably don't. But ours does, and my guess is many others do as well. The restriction of the pop, I'll just tell you very quickly that we got up front $1.9 million for our Coke contract. It's not a secret. We did. And we get $45,000 a year from them. We also make off of various vending machines. The kids do, usually for clubs or whatever they raise the money for, $20,000 to $24,000 a month over, remember, we have 100 schools. We have 10 high schools, so you're typically talking about high schools. And then again, that money is pooled and divided so that there's not a competitiveness there to push, you know, these types of food.
Okay. Yes. Is your contract, I imagine it goes for a period of time.
Correct.
And is it an incremental contract that you have to meet expectations? As was testified earlier, you sell 5% more each year and you...
Senator Starr, Senator Morissette, no. Actually, the contract, I'm not sure why they contracted with us. Most of the stipulations are for them, not us, and we sort of set them, and they were very open to that, and it's a good partnership. So part of this is local control. I mean, it's easy to say we shouldn't be doing this just for money, but the $20,000 to $24,000 a month funds some programs and some services to kids that we do not get state funding for because of the low levels and all the budget cuts. So we don't have much choice. And if you have any more questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Mr. Chairman, Chuck Bennett, Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Just want to second the comments from Patty O'Sullivan from Portland Public Schools. I talked to a number of school districts today, called around to kind of get a feel for this. I don't have copies of their policy, and I apologize for that. But I found that generally what I ran across was no machines in elementary schools was generally the situation. I couldn't find anyone that had them. I didn't call Springfield, so they apparently have one. I'd be interested in where it's located, because what I found when I checked on middle schools was they tended to be either in the teacher's lounge or in the gymnasium and only turned on for after-school activities. And in the high school, also, they were generally running into issues with their food service provider, and they had a non-competitive agreement, and it would turn them off during lunch hours as well. What I found was that the numbers generally described to me were around 80% of the sales occurred in after-school activities, primarily during games and whatever other activities occur after school, where access to a vending machine occurs during any hours we would all agree are appropriate for anyone to have access to either a food or a beverage vending machine. I got to say, the question of the money came up once. Just so you know, I realize the characterization is popular with schools because they're so badly underfunded to suggest that everything we do is over money. In this case, that's really not the situation. Yes, they do provide. North Clackamas was the one that gave me an example, and Ron Naso, the superintendent up there, asked me to be sure to ask you how you all would replace the $150,000 a year netted from their entire food service program, which includes this portion. In checking with Salem Kaiser, they have a contract, I believe, with Pepsi. Their second big seller, behind Pepsi, is water. And that seemed to be a very common theme, was water, fruit juices, etc. I think the problem with the bill, and I think in asking us to assist you in amending it, is this needs to go to your local school board and be discussed with your local school board. The kind of issues I heard discussed about national issues, these kind of broad stroke discussions, don't seem to come into play at the local level, or they have been resolved at the local level based on the community's tolerance for location of the machines, for contract, or whatever. The other reality of them is that most commonly, and I'm just going to go to the national contracts. I don't know much about national contracts. I'm not put off that Pepsi shows up in a school or Coke or whomever. But what happened here in Salem Kaiser, as I understand it, is it was an irrational system going building by building, each principal putting in their own machines with whatever was there. And what they have done is centralize it, get control of it, get control of the income and the costs, and they feel have control over it in terms of the community. If it chooses to change policy at the local level, they have a way of doing it because they have a centralized contract. The feeling I ran into was that if it dealt exclusively with national company contracts or larger single contracts, all you'd have is a kind of, again, the anarchy of every school having its vending machine. So it depends on what your target is, I guess, when you're writing the bill. But frankly, in researching this, I kind of was looking for the problem and I couldn't find it.
May I?
Yes.
I had another bill that you guys opposed that dealt with teaching nutrition. Now, is that a problem? Maybe we don't teach kids proper nutrition. You didn't like that bill either.
Senator, we could go into their homes and help their parents feed them correct. I mean, that's the kind of, you know, we can teach kids nutrition. I think we do in the elementary school. I had one superintendent tell me that the target is to teach children proper nutrition by age 14, and that is their objective. We're pretty comfortable. I mean, we can mandate all sorts of things. The question is, when do we get to where the issue really resides, and it appears to be where the child resides, and you can have us trying to solve every problem, but
you know.
And Senator Moore said, I believe that we only opposed the third section of that bill, which was adding curriculum without adding money to teach or telling us what we shouldn't teach, why we teach what was in your bill. I believe we did support sections 1 and 2, which were the grant program for developing some new updated curriculum for health programs. And then if the schools wish to adopt those, they could.
I appreciate your opposition in the sense that it causes us to find ways to do things without money, and that's what we're trying to do, because money is the name of the game. And I know the legislature has not replaced the money that you used to get from local taxes. I know that, but you know. So I do appreciate your participation. You've come with some good ideas and some good suggestions, and I understand your position, but I think that there is a bigger picture. But thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, just very briefly, I could appreciate the motives of the proponents of this measure, but we believe very strongly that their arguments and proposals should more appropriately be directed to local school boards where these decisions are made. And it's clear from some of the discussion that you've heard and some of the examples we've provided, many school districts, we haven't had a chance to sample all of them, but it appears that many school districts have already adopted local policies that, in effect, match the requirements that you're suggesting in this bill. We're often suggestions are often made when it comes to funding that we ought to seek business partners to try to leverage resources and make the resources that are available to schools go as far as possible. And while some of our business partners might provide computers or other kinds of materials and supplies, some of our business partners also happen to be in the business of selling beverages and foods, and those I think have an appropriate place in the context of school at a certain time and certain places. It was during the interim, we got into a discussion with one of the interim committees, I don't remember which one, and the issue of adequate school funding came up. And the question was, how do we know when schools are adequately funded? And I suggested that one way to tell when schools were adequately funded is schools were no longer trying to get Coke and Pepsi into a bidding war to see how much money could be raised in order to fund extracurricular activities, sports fields, and so forth that weren't being able to be funded out of the general fund. I think it's more appropriate that we try to focus students' attention on their choices and make clear to them and try to instill in them that every choice they make has consequences, and some of the consequences are positive and some are negative. In conclusion, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, again, I think that the motives here are sound, but the discussion and the argument ought to be more appropriately focused on a local school board where we believe these decisions are best made. I could go into some of the provisions of Section 5 regarding actions that the local school districts are required to take to comply with the provisions of this measure. Every time I see the word shall post a sign, shall submit an annual report, shall document compliance, that to me indicates some kind of another mandate, and it seems ironic that there's a great deal of discussion here about trying to relieve school districts of some statutory mandates, while at least in Section 5, I guess it is, appears to create additional mandates on us. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to respond to any questions.
I have a question.
Senator Marcet, yes.
I really appreciate the comments about local control and so on, and who is paying for local education and who is not paying for it, but I would like to know who is going to pay for nearly the 70% of cases of cardiovascular disease related to obesity. Who's going to pay for the risk of heart disease, stroke, high blood pressure, diabetes, gallbladder disease, arthritis, breathing problems, and forms of cancer, and so on? The state ends up paying for that one way or another. The state has a compelling interest in the health of its children and in the education of its children, a compelling interest. So I think it's valid that the state mandate, so to speak, that there are certain health standards met in your school system. It's not your school system, it's our school system. So yeah, the same argument is used by, why do you tax the poor smoker, the poor drinker? Well, because the state ends up taking care of the poor smoker and the poor drinker in the end. We spend millions and multi-millions of dollars. So it is a local issue to some extent. The state ends up paying the ultimate bill for a lot of illnesses that occur in our society, and I think the state has a compelling interest to help prevent those illnesses, and so that's why I think this is a state issue.
But I would also argue, Mr. Chair and Senator Morissette, there's been no compelling evidence that school districts haven't in some way already responded to what you're suggesting are the problems, at least from the Portland School District perspective, and the school districts that Mr. Bennett surveyed indicate that school districts already have in place policies that in effect mirror the requirements that you're proposing in statute. And again, from the standpoint of the folks that I represent, those locally elected officials out there, the suggestion that they're somehow blind to the nutritional needs of students and the issues that you've raised and are just ready to sell out to any Tom, Dick, and Harry that comes down the street with a bag of money, I think is false. And so I think what you're hearing is that we're already doing this, and we don't need the state, and it's certainly, and it's one, as you argue, a compelling interest to tell us to do what we're already essentially doing.
Mm-hmm. May I ask you a question?
Yes.
Do you think that the local jurisdictions gave up their local compelling interest when they passed ballot measure 5 and said the state is now our school board? The state is now going to take care of us. I'm wondering if the people in the local school districts who supported that knew what they were doing when they gave up control of their schools. They would not be in the money situation today.
It's late in the afternoon, and I just had a cup of coffee, and I won't go on this topic for another hour and a half, but I do not believe when Oregonians voted for Measure 5, or at least a majority of them, a single one suggested that the legislature become a 90-member school board.
Oh, I think they probably thought that was what was going to happen.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. We are running on, and this is a public hearing, and we have some more people who want to testify. We'll invite John Powell and Kathy Kaiser and Jim McMillan. Please come forward.
Oh, Billy.
Chair, do you want to stand in a certain order? Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Kathy Kaiser. I live in Kaiser. Don't laugh. And I am a mom. I have two sons, an 18-year-old who is a freshman at Oregon State University, and a 3-year-old. I'm director of sales for the Coca-Cola Bottling Company of Oregon. Our local bottling company has over 500 employees who live and raise their families in the local communities in which we do business and work in our facilities in Bend, North Bend, Medford, The Dalles, Tualatin, and Wilsonville. I also am president of the Oregon Soft Drink Association. The statewide trade association that represents 17 local soft drink bottlers with 27 facilities in communities throughout the state. I testify today in opposition of Senate Bill 651. First of all, the Coca-Cola Bottling Company of Oregon and all local soft drink bottlers throughout the state offer a wide variety of beverages in schools. Schools with whom we have relationships already offer waters, juices, sports drinks, dairy-based drinks, and teas in their vending machines, in addition to carbonated, regular, and diet drinks. Second, consumption of carbonated soft drinks in schools is minimal. On average, in 2002, in schools in which my bottling company does business, students consumed one carbonated soft drink every 7.7 days. That's less than one carbonated soft drink per week. And students consumed one drink of any kind of the wide variety of beverages we offer, carbonated and non-carbonated, every 6.9 days. Again, less than one per week. Third, presented the wide variety of choice, students are consuming almost as many non-carbonated beverages, including water and 100% juices and sports drinks, as they are carbonated beverages, 45% to 55%. We respect parents, teachers, and students' decisions to make the beverage choices for their schools. We respect individual choice, and as a mom, I and we think parents, not the government, should have the right to decide what their children can or cannot eat. There are good and bad lifestyles, not good and bad foods. Obesity is a complex problem with no easy solutions. Clearly, lack of physical activity plays a primary role. Other factors include one's environment, dietary habits, and time spent in front of the television or computer screen. It's most important to stress more daily exercise and a balanced diet. Blaming particular foods won't help the obesity problem. The fact is that young and old alike need to adhere to the tried and true principle of everything in moderation. Soft drinks are simply a beverage choice. And I, as I indicated earlier, students are given and are making responsible choices and consuming a wide variety of beverages. The Coca-Cola Bottling Company of Oregon has a long-standing tradition of supporting youth development and education, as well as physical activity and a healthy, active lifestyle. And we believe local businesses like local soft drink bottlers should partner with schools in their communities by providing support for academic and athletic programs. Supporting youth in education is part of being a responsible local business. Local soft drink bottlers in Oregon, members of the Soft Drink Association of Oregon, and our industry employees have demonstrated a strong commitment to their communities and local schools for many decades. From scholarships and employee mentoring programs to educational grants, these responsible business partners have generated supplemental funds to help school districts with activities like music programs, the production of yearbooks and school newspapers, instructional materials, field trips, arts and theater programs, computers and other technology equipment, after-school activities, and sports and physical education equipment, including athletic uniforms and scoreboards. Local soft drink bottlers help promote physical activity in schools. Proper physical and nutrition education and a healthy, active lifestyle through athletic programs and activities, not food bans, are the key to weight control. The state should not legislate eating habits. Parents and local schools should be the ones to determine what students should be eating. Current law permits that, and that's where it should stay. As a mom, I promote that with my children, and they are healthy and active. I want them to be able to make decisions not only about what beverages they consume, but also other issues. Teaching young people how to make appropriate decisions is the key, not only with regard to nutrition, education, but frankly, with all important issues they will face throughout their lives. There's three points I would like to make. In the last 20 years, caloric intake has increased by 1% in children. Obesity has increased by 10% in children. Physical education declined by 13% in children. I think as a mom, if there's anything I can do for my kids, it's to teach them how to make a good decision, because I'm not always going to be there to help them to make that decision. They need to be able to make a good decision because I'm not always going to be there, and we cannot expect our government to legislate things all along to help us to have our kids make those decisions. I urge committee members to vote no on Senate Bill 651. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Who's next? My name is Jim McMillan. I'm here to support Kathy's passion for, you know, I can only echo what she said here. I think the key piece here is that obesity is a very, very complex issue. There's really no one source to blame it on, but there are things we can do and that the Coca-Cola system and our industry is doing in order to help address these issues, and that is having the right brands to offer to the students, including including non-carbonated beverages, 100% juices and waters, supporting youth development, but also letting having people have the opportunity to make a choice themselves.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell. Before you, representing the Northwest Automatic Vending Association. Mr. Chairman, I will cut my testimony short because many of the points I was going to make have been made already. I do want to let you know that NAVA, or the organization I represent, is made up of primarily small vendors, not the purveyors of the large national contracts or international corporations. We are not in the business of poisoning anyone or making anyone obese. I think our sales normally would be proof of that. As was pointed out by previous witnesses, we argue that there is a slim margin as a vendor, and that's because it's the truth. And so the big contract issues that you've been heard about, I think, are a totally different set of issues and involve a different discussion. These issues, I think, around the question of obesity, one would have to look at the entire problem of obesity. And I would challenge you to give this issue the Costco test. Just stand at the exit of a Costco on a Saturday for just 5 minutes. That's where the decisions on obesity are being made. Products that are vended in any vending machine go out of those stores in boxes of dozens at a time, while the children are eating a hot dog as they leave. So the question of obesity is far removed from a vending machine only. We were unaware as an association that any grade school had a vending machine. I'm unaware of any of our members that have placed vending machines in elementary schools. However, we are aware that for breakfast they may get an egg and sausage sandwich and pizza for lunch under the school food program that is not vended. It has been stated that there are no regulations on competitive foods. That is inaccurate. In fact, the Department of Education does have regulations on when a vending machine and what can be operative and where it can be while the school lunch program and breakfast program is in operation. I can provide the committee copies of those, including a requirement for the school board to take action. If only milk was served in schools, you would have a controversy much like the one we're having here today. I clipped an article that was in a news service dated February 24th of 2003. In New York, they're experimenting with a milk program in the public schools. The machines are identified with the black and white print to make them attractive. But it's still controversial because although whole milk, whole and 2% milk are leading sources of total and saturated fat in children's diets, 2 out of 3 children who drink milk with school lunch choose it over the lower fat versions. So even if it was just milk, it could still be controversial. So, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we do not believe that this legislation is in the best interest of the public schools. We know that it's not in the best interest of our members. And if just doing away with our members' service in schools would solve the obesity problem, that would be a different story. But we just don't believe it will. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much. Mary Hartzheim. And then we have two more supporters of the bill, Mel Cohen
and Amanda Laporte. Come on up, please, and we're going to get this completed here by 5 o'clock or sooner, I hope. Thank you.
Hi. Chair Starr, members of the committee, my name is Mary Hartzheim, and I'm here on behalf of the Grocery Manufacturers of America, and I'm testifying in opposition of the bill. Our organization is a national organization, and our members comprise Swatching Associations, food manufacturing companies, and the folks who produce the foods that are in the vending machines. And instead of just repeating some of the comments that are already made, I am going to submit my written testimony. And one point I would like to reiterate, though, is that it sounded to me, if I heard the testimony earlier right, that there was some suggestion that there aren't any standards currently for the sale of these foods, and that's incorrect. I'll echo what John Powell said, and that there are federal standards restricting when these vending machines can be in use, and restricting all foods that are competing with the federal nutrition programs and the lunch and breakfast program.
Thank you very much. Please.
Chair Starr and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Mel Cohn. I'm a pediatrician, and I'm the state epidemiologist at the Department of Human Services. And what I'd really like to do today to add to the comments that have already been made is just to underscore with you the importance of the health effects related to obesity that really this bill is trying to address. You know, we are really in the midst of an obesity epidemic in this country, and unfortunately, Oregon is in the lead, as Senator Morissette has already noted here. Oregon was the first state on the West Coast where more than 20% of adults report a weight that puts them in the obese category. And I'm sad to say that California and Idaho have joined us in the year 2001. These are year 2000 data. So this is a problem that is growing and growing, if you'll pardon the pun. Now, there are many things that contribute to this epidemic, and certainly obesity among adults is a big problem, but obesity among children is a particularly alarming problem, and I say that not only as a public health practitioner, but certainly as a pediatrician and as a parent as well. Some of the health problems that obesity puts kids and adults at risk for include very prominently diabetes. I mean, when I was in medical school, which was about 15 years ago, we learned about type 2 diabetes that was known as adult onset diabetes. Well, it's not just adult onset diabetes anymore. This is an obesity-related disease, and it is being seen more and more among children. This is a disease that has dire consequences, including amputation, blindness, and all of the bad things that go along with having the disease diabetes. In addition, for kids, there are a lot of psychosocial consequences that kids experience who are overweight. They're seen as unpopular, unhygienic, lazy, poor school performers, and so forth. And particularly for kids at the preteen and early teen years, when self-esteem is such a big issue for these kids, you know, to have to deal with all of the consequences related to obesity, it's really a very, very difficult thing for children to deal with, and often is associated with all kinds of unhealthy risk behaviors, unsafe sexual activity, all kinds of drug use, and perhaps even depression and suicide. So these are very serious things that affect children's lives, and I really want to underscore that with you. I'm not going to go through all of the details that are in my written testimony. You have that. I did want to say one word or two, however, about this idea of choice. You know, we really do need to make the healthy choice the easy choice, not only for adults, but for children in our communities. And children's choice is very much determined by the environment that they're in, whether it's the home environment where they spend a lot of time or the school environment where they also spend a lot of time. It's really not within children's control to determine that environment. That's our responsibility as adults. And so I think what happens in that school environment in terms of promoting healthy eating is really critical in addressing the problem of youth obesity that we're seeing in Oregon and in this country as a whole. With that, I'm going to close my remarks. I'll be happy to answer any questions. The department was in support of the original draft of this bill, and I will be happy to take any amendments that are brought forward back to the department and have them considered appropriately.
One of the former witnesses suggested that caloric intake had only gone up 1% and that the exercise regimen had gone down, that in fact it might be a greater contributing factor to obesity than the caloric intake. Is this generally accepted knowledge and research, or how do you see? I see these kids out here on skateboards and all, and they don't seem to be obese, but the kids that are not working out tend to be more on the...
Chair Starr, there's no doubt that decreasing physical activity plays a very important role in this, and I think we have a lot to do to encourage more physical activity in our youth. And the lack of physical education, for example, in our schools is a big problem, and one that has undoubtedly contributed to this, as well as a whole variety of other things in the ways that our communities are built and so forth. Notwithstanding, what makes somebody obese is the balance between how much they're taking in terms of calories and how much they expend in terms of physical activities. And it really doesn't take a very big imbalance to very rapidly lead to pretty impressive weight gain. And one of the examples that I've heard is that if you were to eat one Reese's peanut butter cup a day extra, not change your physical activity, but just that little bit increase, you would put on a pound of body weight in a month's time. That would be 12 pounds in a year. Now, you're talking about young children. 12 pounds is, it's a lot for any of us, but particularly for a child, that's a lot of weight to put on. So I'm very much in support of us doing things to encourage physical activity, promote physical activity in youth, but we also do need to address the intake side of this as well, and I think this bill takes an important step towards doing that. It's not going to solve the problem altogether. It's a first step, but an important one, I think.
Appreciate that very much. I just, as a matter of record, I kept caloric intake records during my college career, and I averaged 10,000 calories a day. Never gained a pound. Very few people ate that much, but very few people worked 70 hours a week. It took a full college load either. With that, I think we've concluded our testimony, and appreciate very much your attention, your being here for this important bill.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. With that, we close the public hearing and adjourn the Senate Education Committee.
You try to give me all that cake. I need it.